Why is it that we can phone in sick with flu, but not with depression? I'm David Baker, and in this edition of In Business, I'm asking how much employers should be concerned about their employees' mental health. It's a big topic at the moment, and many people are working hard to remove the stigma which still exists when it comes to our psychological rather than physical well-being. But behind all the noise, is there now a real change happening in the workplace?
I'm afraid I think that at the moment mental health is a bit trendy. It's a bit like the new diversity. Companies want to say they're good at it because it looks good to suppliers and the outside world. It's very easy to do the PR and to talk about how great you are. But actually, is that translating on the ground?
That's Karen Jackson, a former Citi trader and now a lawyer specialising in employment. But whatever the intention, one problem is, how do we define mental health in the first place?
Oh, such a big one, isn't it?
Amy Stein has been working as a human resources manager for 25 years.
Sometimes mental health gets confused with stress, which is, again, an interesting debate and really popular in the HR world to talk about right now, stress management. But stress can be both good and bad. And mental health, I think, is much more wide-reaching. So I think people do understand about dealing with issues of depression and anxiety in the workplace, but there's also eating disorders, there's drug abuse, drink abuse, all sorts of issues that fall into mental health. But there's also, I don't know if we talk about this, but is it also about, for example, if I have autism or if I'm on the spectrum, does that fall into mental health issues? So I think we define it differently.
So, if there's a problem of definition, what does the law say?
Well, a mental health disability in the Equality Act is a mental impairment. Doesn't matter what it's called, any kind of diagnosis. There may even be an instance where you don't have a formal diagnosis, but you just know something is wrong. But it has to have a long-term effect, which means lasting 12 months or longer or lifetime. And it has to have a substantial adverse effect on day-to-day life. So it's about how does having a mental impairment functionally impair your ability to go about your normal day-to-day business.
Does that mean it sort of takes into account almost everything, if you like, from depression through to bipolar disorder to maybe even things like alcohol addiction or drugs addiction?
It captures any form of mental impairment, provided you can show that it is long-term and substantial.
Karen Jackson. So the law sees physical and mental health issues as the same. But as Karen knows only too well, that doesn't always translate into reality.
There's a couple of things which strike me as particularly pertinent around mental health. One is you never really know how long it's going to take somebody to get better. If somebody has a heart attack, they'll be off work, they might have surgery, there's a return to work plan, 6 weeks on, they'll probably be ready to come back to work. Somebody has a breakdown of some description mentally, they could be back at work in 8 weeks, taking meds, having counselling and be perfectly fine. They could be off for 2 years. And I think that explains why a lot of times employers get scared and they cut off communication. And when you cut off that communication, you upset somebody. I've lost count of the number of people that have come to me and said, I've reported depression, I took time off, and I never heard another thing. Whereas my buddy who had cancer, he got flowers, he got a card, everybody at work had a whip round, and they, you know, were wanting to welcome him back.
I sort of buried my head in the sand for many, many years, and I can safely say that losing my mum at the age of 12 and therefore shutting down all of my emotions for the last 20 years has had a quite serious effect on not only my personal life but also my work as well.
Prince Harry talking about his own mental health issues. Celebrities and members of the royal family are helping to bring this topic out into the open. But there's still a real powerful stigma around talking about mental health issues, especially in the workplace. Amy Stein.
In the same way, I have had a lot of female friends who, when they become pregnant or are trying to get pregnant, are terrified to tell their employer that they're trying to get pregnant. I mean, like, is it 1962? It's terrifying, right? And people are still saying, I'm scared to tell my manager I'm trying to get pregnant because I'm worried if I do that, that I'm going to be looked over for promotion, I'm going to be discriminated against. Maybe even in the case of one friend of mine, I'm worried I'm going to get fired. And if people are that scared about talking about being pregnant, imagine the fear of talking about struggling with depression, because there are real stereotypes. If you're struggling with depression, somehow you can't cope, you're not strong enough. There's so many prejudices. I think people have every reason to be scared of it.
Now, some people would say, well, the law protects these people, just like it protects people regarding physical health, no? You're shaking your head.
No, it's ridiculous. No, it doesn't. I mean, on paper, it does. But the reality is that there are lots of ways to fire someone or lots of ways to not promote someone that can easily get around what the laws are.
And it's not only employees who find this topic difficult. The first port of call for any mental health issues you're facing in the workplace is going to be your line manager. Meet Jane, not her real name, who was working, of all places, in the care sector.
We had been colleagues for a while, and then I was promoted into position managing this person. Within my first week, they'd made a serious self-harm attempt on themselves and ended up in hospital. And that was just the start of it. I was a junior manager. I'd never managed anybody before in my life, never been a boss. This was all new to me, and I was just absolutely all at sea.
What was going through your mind when they came to you, showing you the injury?
Utter shock. Wondering what they were going to do next and wondering what to do. I'd done management courses before. Not one of them ever say, this is what you need to do if somebody comes to you in significant mental distress. I'd had no preparation for it.
What did you say to them in the first instance?
I think I urged them to get medical help. And I said, I'm no medic, I have no training, but you really need to go to the hospital and get this sorted out.
Meanwhile, other members of her team were becoming resentful about the amount of time she was spending trying to manage the situation. So Jane, who herself suffers from depressive episodes, did what we'd all do, went to her own boss to get some much-needed advice.
I was in quite a small office with a particular room we'd go to, and I said, can I have a word? And I said, the situation with this person is really affecting me. I'm not sleeping properly. I'm becoming very depressed. I know the signs. And he sort of nodded. And he said, well, you know you can't be depressed now you're a line manager, don't you?
Jane's is a shocking case. But unfortunately, it's not unusual. Employment lawyer Karen Jackson.
I think we're a long, 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 long way off where we need to be, and that is not an exaggeration. I'm pleased that there's talk about it. I started doing this work 10 years ago and nobody was talking about it. So I do see some progress. But I also have cases where I'm acting against mental health charities. So I know that, you know, things aren't where they need to be and there is still a lot to be done. You know, my practice is busier than it ever has been and there's no let up in the number of people that fall out of work because they have mental illness.
It's about 9 o'clock in the morning and I'm here in one of Britain's biggest Royal Mail sorting offices. I'm here with Sean Davis from the Royal Mail. Sean, what are we seeing here? What's going on around us?
So this is our usual morning preparation. This is where we've got a number of our postmen and women preparing to go out on delivery. They're currently operating at the sorting frames, laying out what we call their walks or their rounds.
The Royal Mail is one of a number of big companies that are taking the mental health of its employees seriously. Sean Davis is the grandly named Global Director of Safety, Health, Wellbeing and Sustainability. He says there's a strong business case for this.
Having people at work, keeping them at work, is good for the organisation in terms of productivity, it's good for the organisation in terms of customer satisfaction and care, but it's also, and more importantly, good for the individual, the employee, their sense of purpose and contribution, etc. So it's win-win.
The Royal Mail has introduced a programme for its 140,000 employees called First Class Mental Health.
We have issued all our employees with what we call a Z card or a Constantina card, a pocket-sized card that they can use to refer to help people, signpost people to mental health services.
So take me through what actually happens. You know, I'm an employee of the Royal Mail, I've got my Z card, I'm feeling close to depression or I'm feeling close to anxiety. What do I do next?
So the first thing is your line manager will have had mental health training. So we've created a competent manager, someone who's comfortable to have a mental health conversation. Then either by you disclosing it directly to them or by them observing it or by a colleague observing it, they've seen that you are acting not your usual self. So it might be that you've been particularly quiet and you're normally jovial. It might be that you're particularly snappy when that's not your characteristic. Now, what we're not saying is that using that, we immediately diagnose you've got a mental health problem. You might just be tired. The neighbours might have kept you awake, the children might have kept you awake, the dog might have been barking, any number of things. What we do, though, for that is use that as an opportunity to say, you know, how are you doing today? Really, really importantly is waiting for the person to tell you how they feel. One of my personal issues that I struggle with is people say, hi, how are you? And they carry on walking. If you're really bothered enough to ask, then stop and wait for the person to tell you. Because that 2-3 second opportunity might be the only one that that person gets that day. And it might just be that they need to say, well, actually, I'm not that great. I'm really struggling.
And the Royal Mail is not alone in introducing mental health welfare programmes for its staff. They're now also becoming a big deal in a sector that's not best known for its sense of compassion. I'm in the city of London in Canary Wharf, and I'm surrounded by huge, tall buildings, dozens of stories high, lots of windows here, tens of thousands of people working all around us. And if anyone thinks of the world of work, of high pressure, of long hours, this is the image that comes to mind. And I'm here to see Jessica Carmody, a consultant at KPMG. Jessica is a successful management consultant in her mid-30s. She has a long history of depression, which has sometimes been at odds with the working culture around her. Things came to a head when she was working for a previous employer.
I'd been working on a project for 13 months and the hours had got progressively longer and longer. So I was probably working about 15 hours a day at the point where I noticed that I really wasn't doing so well and I probably needed to take some time out. I probably needed to have some holiday.
This is maybe 15 hours a day. What, 5 days a week, 6 days a week, 7 days a week?
I was definitely working 15 hours a day, 5 days a week, and then I was working at the weekends, probably 7 hours a day each day at the weekend as well. So I did ask my boss one afternoon if I could take the afternoon off because I was feeling very overwhelmed and I was tearful when I had that conversation. And my boss didn't really respond at all, looked surprised that I was asking, said, you better go then, and didn't continue the conversation. So I came back the next day and carried on. But soon after that point, she said to me that she felt it was best if I didn't carry on the project.
And pretty quickly, that led to her looking for another job. At KPMG, she now has a more understanding boss.
I have an intelligent working arrangement where I can take some days to work at home if I want to. So, for example, I might say I'm coming into the office on a Monday, but on Tuesday I want a quiet day at home so I can focus without meetings on getting some things done. I could also take breaks during the day if I need to, and I work in different geographies, so I have calls with New York and India and various other places. So I can manage my day around those meetings so that if I'm feeling tired, which is a symptom of my illness, I can take a break if I want to. That's what intelligent working means to me. And it's really helpful for my health.
Now, you're very open about your own mental health. Do you ever now feel that might affect your career?
I do think it might affect my career because I can't tell what every individual out there believes about mental health. And I know that there are people out there that don't believe what I believe about mental health. But I've got a lot of good things going for me and my health is under control, fortunately. So I'm taking care of myself and I'm doing what I can to progress. And I have every reason to believe that I will be successful.
This whole business of disclosure can be tricky. And it's something that the charity, business and the community has looked closely at. Louise Aston is its director of well-being.
Disclosure is a really tough one because with awareness raising is if you're disclosing in an empathetic environment where your employer will actually provide you with that support and does listen actively, then that's great. And we're seeing more of that. But the really, really disturbing stat that came out of our report, our Mental Health at Work report, is of those 15% of employees who did disclose, they subsequently were disciplined, demoted, or even dismissed. So if you scale that up nationally, that's about 1.2 million people affected.
Think about that. That's a really shocking figure.
Well, this is a discussion I always have with clients.
Karen Jackson, employment lawyer.
It doesn't sit well with me, but my advice to them is if you disclose at interview that you have a mental, you know, long-standing mental health condition, you probably won't get past interview.
And what does the law say about that?
Well, the Equality Act does contain a provision around recruitment and discrimination in recruitment, but it's really difficult to prove that that's the reason you haven't advanced because they could say, you know, they had a better candidate who was just better all round on paper. So my advice to candidates is, unless you need adjustments at the initial interview, don't say anything until you've got the job, got your feet under the table, and only at the point where you need help from your employer should you reveal that you've got anything that's going on.
Paris, July 2016. The final of football's European Championships. For Bernie Ross, this was the culmination of months and months of the most intense work. As head of broadcasting for UEFA, European football's governing body, he was in charge of all live football broadcasts across the world. And as his wife Jacinta Evans says, it was an incredibly pressurised time.
He was working superhuman hours and he was allowed to take on far too much work, over 18 hours a day, and was managing to operate on very, very little sleep in a highly energised fashion. And he was achieving a great deal, actually. It was highly successful, but Bernie felt very isolated, which meant he didn't have anyone to turn to talk about any feelings that he had, that he might be being overwhelmed. He paid a very high price for that.
After the tournament, Bernie's health really began to deteriorate.
He was exhausted. Bernie became increasingly tense and paranoid and had very strange feelings of everyone being out to get him. Now I know that all these are typical symptoms of somebody suffering from bipolar.
Bernie had never suffered from bipolar disorder before, but despite his worsening health, he carried on working. Jacinta says that as Bernie had been verbally promised a promotion, they'd begun to plan relocating the family closer to UEFA's headquarters in Switzerland. And it was while on such a trip, to look at houses, that Bernie checked the family into a hotel in Geneva, which broke the company's expenses policy.
UEFA have a rule that you're not to stay in hotel accommodation within a certain radius of their offices in Nyon, and Geneva falls into that radius, and that's what we did. We stayed in a hotel. And it was an ill-judged snap decision late at night. He was very tired and it was totally out of character and he'd never done it before. He apologised and he offered to pay and thought it was all cleared up.
But it wasn't. Soon afterwards, Bernie Ross's 11-year career at UEFA came to an end. For legal reasons, we can't say any more about this.
I have to ask you this, but with all this deterioration, what evidence is there that it was the work that caused Bernie's mental decline?
Well, it is more common for bipolar to come on in the teen years and in the 20s. That's definitely true. And this is something I asked and asked and asked of the doctors myself because, to be honest, I was desperate to have a different diagnosis. I kept thinking it must be something else. So we went right to the top.
They saw some of the leading specialists in mental health, both in the UK and in Switzerland. And they all agreed that his condition had been brought on by stress.
There's no doubt that when bipolar disorder comes on in later life, it is always due to a significant life stressor. And that, in this case, would be work.
All the specialists that Jacinta and Bernie saw agreed that there was a clear link between work and Bernie's deteriorating health. So what was he like before all this happened?
He was very, well, obviously very successful, very hard-working, but also extremely calm. He has a reputation for being very calm under pressure. That's why he's so good at live TV and always keeps his head when all those around him are not. And very funny, good sense of humour. One of his colleagues said to me, you know, I've worked with Bernie for 10 years and in all that time I think he might have got cross with me once, and even then I'm not really sure if he was cross or not. That's the sort of boss he was. And so if you think of anyone you know, the least likely person to suffer from a mental illness of this kind, that would be Bernie.
So what does she think UEFA should have done?
They should have been able to foresee that anybody with that kind of workload and that increased work pressure was going to pay a price health-wise, in my opinion.
Did he at any point go to his bosses and say, look, I'm really working too hard, I need a bit of a break?
Yes, he had pointed out to them that he was burning the candle at both ends and that it was intolerable and that it was unsustainable.
Did he not at any point just think, listen, I've had enough, I'm going to chuck it out, I'm going to go work somewhere else?
No, he loved his job, he wanted to stay there, it was his dream job and he was very committed and he had a fantastic team and he was very committed to his team and to getting the job done.
And for those people listening who haven't caught up on where Bernie is now, what's happening at the moment?
Well, he's gone missing and the last known sighting of him was on the 31st of October, so we're all desperately worried.
And if he could hear you now, what would you like to say to him?
I would say come home because, you know, we can get through it together, but he needs to come home and get well and be surrounded by the people that do value him and love him. And
I can't imagine how hard this must be for you. I can't imagine anything worse.
Thinking that he might be dead in a ditch somewhere or something is just horrendous.
Since we recorded that interview, Bernie Ross has been found safe in Switzerland and is currently receiving medical help. We asked UEFA for an interview. They declined, saying it was a private matter. But they did give us this statement.
UEFA is pleased that Bernie Ross has been found and is safe. Throughout the time Bernie was missing, we had been in contact with the police, both in the UK and in Switzerland, to see whether we could offer any assistance in this matter. Bernie Ross was a highly valued and respected member of the UEFA staff. Any suggestion of misconduct or maltreatment of Mr. Ross on the part of UEFA would be wholly untrue.
Bernie Ross's case is an extreme one, but it highlights a wider problem, that work can make you ill. Many of us are working longer and longer hours, and that itself is leading to mental health problems, including, according to lawyer Karen Jackson, widespread self-medication.
I'm actually shocked at how rife addiction is in the workplace. It's everywhere. I'm not sure enough is being done to address it. Again, it's a massive issue.
Is there something wrong with the culture of work, do you think?
I certainly do. I mean, I think certainly since the recession, people have been a lot more insecure about jobs. We know that people are in more debt than ever before. So there is that need to keep a job. So there's a huge amount of pressure builds around work. And I'm absolutely certain. I mean, we know, for example, that in the legal profession, lawyers abuse alcohol. And it is because, and I speak as a lawyer myself, we have quite a stressful job. Certainly my job is stressful when I'm dealing with people who are in a really bad way. I have to fight a lot of the time with my opposite numbers. It's a stressful job. And at the end of that day, it's the easiest thing to do is open a bottle of wine and self-medicate. A lot easier than going to the gym.
What all of this brings up is a very tricky question about where the boundary lies between our work and our non-work lives. Things like technology, flexible hours, our on-call work culture are changing the relationship between employee and employer. If managers are going to be concerned about their employees' mental health, including things like addiction, does that mean they have the right to know about what their staff get up to at the weekend, for example, or how things are at home? Human resources manager Amy Stein.
I think the way that I've always dealt with it, and other people might approach it differently, is to say, listen, I can't control your home environment, but this is the way it's manifesting at work. So what can we do about that?
What, to make them manifest better at work, if you like?
Well, to make them conscious of what's happening, to sort of say, what kind of help do you need, right? And it might be if you need help at home because, for example, I once had someone whose partner actually was dealing with manic depression. And so they were acting as a caregiver, an unskilled caregiver, to someone who was, you know, on suicide watch, basically at home because they'd gone down into a deep depression. They weren't skilled in knowing how to cope with that. you know, I can't solve that problem at home for you, but I can point you in the direction of the resources that we have. So, for example, we have a free employee assistance helpline where you can call and talk to a qualified health professional. I can give you that phone number. You can call that qualified health professional. I can say to you, do you need some time off work? So you're not stressed about work. Go down to a 4-day week for the next month if you need to, if that would help you. I can look for ways that we can help cope with that rather than just loading the pressure on and saying, listen, I don't care with what you're coping at home, because that doesn't work. The person just ends up exploding in the workplace one way or another.
This is interesting. For Amy Stein, work can be a way of helping people with all sorts of mental health issues, and not just those brought on at the workplace. But how far can we go with this? I asked Louise Aston from Business in the Community.
Do you think we're going to get to the stage where managers could maybe stop us even having a drink on a Saturday night because they might want to send us an email?
No, I don't. I think obviously the blurring between work and home life is blurring, and a lot of people are talking about work-life integration, but that's also got an upside to it, in I can work where I like, when I like, and be flexible to suit my lifestyle. I think where there is this 24/7 culture, and particularly for organisation that is working across time zones, is there needs to be cut-off points. You can't be available 24/7, and we know that sleep is incredibly important. Companies have adopted policies where they turn their service off at the weekend, and that's up to them. But then, you know, there are some people, some employees, who actually feel better if they check in once a day when they're on holiday to look at their emails. So everybody's different, but we know that with sleep deprivation comes a lot of risk. So, you know, if you're a surgeon, a slip of a hand could kill someone. If you're a finance director, you could be making poor decisions that could cost a lot of jobs.
What about someone who says, yeah, well, you know, if you're a surgeon and you're going through a terrible divorce, or you're a finance director and can't find a partner, you can also make mistakes because of that stress in your outside life. Should companies be involved in finding romance for their employees, for example?
Yeah, why not? Bring it on.
That may be some way off, but I like the idea of employers seeing employees as other human beings rather than as a chair that can easily be replaced. And I like the idea of all of us becoming a bit more involved in our colleagues' lives. It makes us less like cogs in the corporate machine. But that's going to take a lot more destigmatisation of mental health, making it as ordinary and understandable as flu. And for that to happen, we're going to have to bring about a change in culture and attitude that permeates every level of our organisations. This edition of In Business was presented by me, David Baker, and produced by Jim Frank. For other programmes looking deeply at the issues facing the world of work, go to bbc.com/inbusiness.